thing to know, the ways in which the life was elevated by the church, or at least attempts were made by the church to elevate life. We talked about monasticism, talked about the exercise of discipline, both public and private. We talked about education. We were talking about benevolence at the close of the hour, and I was saying that benevolence became institutionalized, and as did beggary. And very often the giving of alms was done for the benefit of the giver, to earn merit, rather than for the benefit of the one who needed it. And as the merit system, as the indulgence system became more thoroughly ingrained in medieval life, beggars became more important. And for this and other reasons, there was no dealing with the causes of poverty. And by the way, we have something analogous to this. When you sometimes you hear a sermon on giving, which when the preacher finishes, what he has actually said is that it's a good business deal. If you give, you'll have more. Just a good tip on the stock market. And I think that's a very sad approach to giving. Think about that. But this was the situation. We move now to chivalry. Now this is I wish I had a lot of time to lecture on this. It's quite interesting, you know, because of, you ever see Camelot? Like, if you want to get a good, I recommend if you want to get a good study on chivalry, listen to the song of, is it Lancelot who sings C'est moi? Who embodies, is that his name? I think it is. He's the one who's saying, who is the man who embodies all the virtues of the knight? It's me, C'est moi, French, you know. There's nobody more noble than I am. You know, it's in Camelot. Very, very funny. You can listen to it. But because of the musical Camelot and because of the Arthurian legend, which I mentioned before when I talked about the Holy Grail, King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, it has become mythologized. But a knightly class did evolve, and the church used it to help raise the level of life. Keep in mind, it was a chaotic, violent age, a lot of fighting, warring, one lord attacking the other, and we've already looked at that. And because what we would call maybe mercenaries or private armies sort of had to be raised to protect the manor, there developed a whole class of men who did nothing but fight. They trained to fight. They lived for that. They were professional fighters. And so the church molded this. The church didn't begin it. But the church promoted it as a way of alleviating barbaric rudeness and taming the fierce fighting instincts. And keep in mind that these people we're talking about now, our ancestors, were the Teutonic peoples, the Anglo-Saxons, who were northern barbarians. Now we understand what we mean by barbarian. It's a comparative term. They were not a part of the old civilization of the Mediterranean world, not a part of the East. And by the way, they've always liked to fight. They liked to fight before they became Christians. They liked to fight after they became Christians. See, who invented football? The Teutonic peoples did. The idea of going out and the idea of energetic violence. It was based, and so when you had the combination of men whose whole life, or generation after generation, they were just born to fight, and they lived their whole life fighting, and they, for instance, they developed it. They developed weaponry that was fearsome. They developed, they bred horses capable. Some of the large, we call workhorses, some of the Percherons, some of these huge horses that you were developed in Europe. They were developed as riding horses. They were developed because knight and the horses were armored, and as well as the knights. Sometimes the knight would need so much armor, they had to take a pulley and lift him up and set him on his horse. And a big horse like that with several hundred pounds of armor, that horse of that size with a knight. And by the way, it was not simply mythology. These men were terrible fighters. They were very crude, cruel men. And we're going to see later when we get to the Crusades that the Muslims learned that when you ran into a peasant carrying a sword, you were okay. But you ran into a knight, you better watch out. Matter of fact, in some of the more backward areas of the Muslims countries, it is still said to children, if you're not good, King Arthur will get you. You know that? Very true. Because the Muslims learned that it was nothing for one of these knights in the Battle of the Crusades to kill 30 or 40 of the Muslim warriors. because they were so well armored and so just so good at it. And their weapons, you know, the mace and the pike and the broadsword. You get in a tight battle, and people would wedge in, and you get a man who really knows what he's doing with a sword that weighs 30 or 40 pounds, that's maybe 8 feet long. It'd be held with both hands. You can imagine what he would cut through almost any armor made. And so it was not simply all, you know, what I'm saying is there was a genuine, not only a fighting spirit, but a fighting ability. Well, it was based on the feudal system and mutual responsibilities. That is, they owed allegiance. He would swear allegiance to his lord, and then he would fight for his lord. There was the church put together a religious ceremony in which the knight would dedicate himself to the service of God and man. Now, I list here some of the ideals of the knighthood. Now, by the way, these are ideals. Did the men live up to them? The answer is seldom. These were seldom observed, but the church was trying to raise life, and so the church sanctioned this, and these were the ideals, and you see this in the Camelot myth, but there were not very men like Sir Lancelot who actually lived up to these ideals. It was a thing of degree. Some did, most didn't. Some did some of the time and not other times. So I list these very quickly. He must believe the teachings of the Holy Church. This is a knight. He must protect the church. Nothing wrong with that. He must by that they meant church lands, primarily. They weren't talking about heretics. They're talking about people who would come in to take the land of the bishop. He must defend the feeble. He must love the land of his birth. He must shrink from no enemy. He must wage implacable war against the infidel. This came in during the Crusades. He must treat vassals according to feudal justice. That is, he could not take advantage of the fact that he was armed and to just steal from the peasants. He must never lie. He must always keep his word. He must always be generous and largesse to all. That is, he became known for his generosity. He had gold, and he would give it away. He was supposed to support the poor and the weak. And he must always champion good against evil. He must always wear a white hat, as it were. Now, those were the ideals, and these were set forth by the church. This is part of the code of chivalry. And men were knighted and honored, and by the way, you have vestiges of this still in England, where men are knighted, and now it's purely ceremonial. But it was an attempt by the church to sort of direct this, to tame it, to use it, and the church did use it. But it was an attempt to, in other words, they were going to fight anyway. You had this warrior class, we would call it. What are you going to do with that? Well, knighthood was an attempt by the church to elevate this a little bit, to control it and tame it. You see that? And did it? Well, yes, some. This brings us to the Crusades, and this is also it would be delightful and interesting to lecture on the Crusades. We've got some books in our general study section of the library just on the Crusades. If you're interested in pursuing it, it's one of the most interesting and hard to understand phenomena in all of Western history, in the history of Western civilization. The Crusades, 1095 to 1292. And our map here shows the Crusades. If you want to get closer later on and really study them, I have a map in your syllabus as well. What is a Crusade? By definition, it was military expeditions designed to win back Palestine from the Turkish Muslims. The Turkish Muslims. How many were there? Well, because of several abortive attempts, it is difficult to count the Crusades. This is what was a Crusade. See, really don't know. There were at least 8 expeditions, which by at least some stretch of the imagination can be called Crusades. What were the underlying causes? Well, I list them here. First of all, there was the military cause. We've already noted that the Seljuk Turks were threatening Constantinople and thereby the security of Europe. Can you see that? Constantinople defended the eastern flank of Europe. Remember that the Muslims had already come through Spain, were turned back at Tours, and this pincher action? What was keeping them out of Eastern Europe? Answer, Constantinople. And they were threatened by this. They were threatening Constantinople, and therefore it was the king to the Holy Roman Empire in particular said, if we're going to fight the Muslims, we're going to fight them anyway, because eventually Constantinople was going to fall, and did fall in 1453. They knew it was going to fall. They said, we'd better fight them here on their own ground, meet them here, than to let them get up into Europe. And so that was one of the motives, a military motive. Secondly, there were economic causes. There was some trade between the East and the West. Trade between the East and the West was extremely important. Europe needed such things as spices because the food was almost inedible anyway. Could not preserve meat. Most of the meat they ate, for instance, in the Middle Ages was half rotten, and so they would cover it up with spices. They needed silks. The wealthy, especially. If you don't believe that, just try wearing homespun long johns and see how much you itch. I'm very serious about that. But the silks worn as undergarments and as bed clothing were extremely soft and comfortable, and just like they didn't like it, you know. And to have, you know, the homespun is very scratchy, very uncomfortable, and the wealthy especially needed the silks. And there were many other things which came from the East. And the Muslims, the Turks often interrupted this trade, especially on the sea routes. Muslim Turks. They were not like the older Muslims. They were more fierce, and they were messing things up. So there were economic causes. They were interrupting the trade. There are many other things. I'll just give you a couple of examples. There are political reasons. That is from back home. See what I'm talking about? There were military reasons, economic reasons. There were political reasons. What was happening in a feudal system, one of the problems you got is that land always went down through the descendants. There was always trouble caused when you had too many descendants. When you had nobles who really could not get an inheritance, or nobles who had been displaced, people who had inheritance but had lost them because the neighbor was stronger or for any other reasons. And so kings who had nobles under them, as the power began to centralize under kings, they had a real problem. They had a lot of people with private armies running around looking for a fight. Keep in mind, said over and over again, this was a troubled, fighting, upset, chaotic kind of time. And so the kings were more than glad to give the nobles with their and the knights and these men with their private armies somebody else to fight. And so, and by the way, one of the real motives that was there was that you had men who sort of had a kingdom but no place to put it, you know. They had sort of a feudal system, but no land. What was promised was that why should we not have land when we belong to God, and the infidels have the ancient holy land? And so the promise was from these kings to these disenfranchised nobles that you can go and carve out your own fiefdom, carve out your own feudal system. They didn't call it that, but carve out your own kingdom, as it were, in the East. And by the way, they did it. They did it. So that was the motive, wasn't it? In other words, to get them out of their hair. If you want a land, don't touch it. In other words, if you want a kingdom, if you want an estate, if you want land, don't take it from one of us. Go to the infidel and get it from them. And it'll solve a lot of problems at home. And it did. So there were political reasons. There were romantic considerations. The call to a crusade constituted, as I say here, a dramatic appeal to glamour and glory in a bleak and restricted age. One of the characteristics of medieval life, which is often brought up by historians, is that medieval life was exceedingly boring. One of the reasons that they had so many festivals, almost half the days in the year were festival days. And the more they had, the more they wanted. That's where the idea of the county fair came from in the medieval world. Are you going to Scarborough Fair? And remember some of the little mercy rhymes that came out of the medieval world. Some of the stories, like always talk about going to the fair. Simple Simon met a pieman going to the fair. And so they were all. And for instance, read about the jousting tournaments that they had in the Arthurian legend. But they already had these. They would knights would needed somebody to fight. They'd just fight each other. They loved, it's like football, as I said. And the Sunday afternoon joust. And how many were killed? Well, two or three maimed and maybe one killed. Pretty good day. But so life was boring. And keep in mind that the call to go, the call to mount up and go and fight has this kind of call has often attracted young people. And let me say this also, that to sort of give you the broad general picture, I don't have time to just go into all kinds of detail, but we're going to wonder how these people could be talked into just getting up and going. Remember, I already told you that they were geographically ignorant. They had no concept of distance, did not have good maps. The average fellow who would just answer the call to the Crusades, let's go to Jerusalem, he didn't know where it was. You know, for him, it was just, you know, a day or so, or two or three days. Say to a person who's never traveled over 8 or 10 or 15 or 20 miles from his home where he was born, his concept of the world is very superstitious and ignorant. You see, you can talk him into going. And also, and I don't think I told you this before, but for instance, in the average age in this day, the average person, you just take the mean age in the Middle Ages, was about 17. By the way, many of the people you read about who did things, who fought battles and who became kings and who led crusades, many of them were teenagers. See, in that day, a child's youth was over by the time he was 12. By the time a boy was 15 or 14 or 15, he was supposed to already be assumed his manhood. If you were 35 or 40 years old, you were going to be an old man. There were a few old people around, but not very many. And historians have agreed, and this sort of dawned on historians in later years, that one of the reasons the Dark Ages were so dark is that most of the people who were leading them were so young. And so they could, does that make sense to you? That is, there was, lifespan was very short, death came very quick. If you got 30 years in, you'd beat the odds. You were 30 years old. And so life was sort of telescoped. And so these were young people, most of them, who went. The average age would have been very young. The average age of those who were on the Crusades was certainly probably under 18. That included the leaders. You figure their life, figure them into it. Well, does that help you understand? Well, you see why there are many other reasons why they would go. And the religious reasons. Whereas the Muslims had traditionally treated Christianity well, Christian pilgrims in what we call the Holy Land had been left alone pretty much. The Turkish Muslims were different. They were interfering with them. And the cry went up, win back the Holy Land from the infidel. And then there was the second religious reason. Susan, will you? Second religious reason is that. Oh, that's the president. Thank you, Susan. Never mind. The second reason is the promise of indulgence from purgatory for those who went was theologically attractive. We're going to come back to this. But you say, well, to go and die and fight the infidel. But you got to figure, life wasn't all that good where you know back on the farm. And if you sign up and go fight, you'll probably die. The odds are that you'll die within 2 or 3 years. But most of them, the odds were they would die in 2 or 3 years anyway. People died of everything. And you understand? In other words, it was not a choice of, well, if I stay home, I'll live to be to a happy old man. And if I go, I'll die young. People died young most of the time anyway. You see what I'm saying? The odds of dying if you went were not a whole lot greater than the odds of dying if you stayed home. And if you stayed home, the church had taught them you could just count on several years in purgatory no matter what, especially if you were poor. And here, I'll get to have adventure. I'll probably die if I stay home anyway. And I can go, and the church later on promised no purgatory if you die on a crusade. That's a pretty good deal, wasn't it? See? You see the country? Life was uncertain anyway. And go, and if I die, find the infidel, I'll stay out of purgatory. Sounds like a pretty good deal. I'll trade off a few years of life to stay out of purgatory. And considering that life was pretty miserable anyway. You add the combination of youth, you see, and all these reasons, and we can help us understand. It was a hysterical age. Superstitious people are always hysterical. They can be talked into things, stampeded. We're going to see that next. Okay, so we have seen military reasons, economic reasons, political reasons, romantic considerations. It's the idea of a call, romantic call. Young men sometimes join the army just kind of out of a romantic spirit. Women too, sometimes. Religious reasons I've given. Come to the First Crusade, 1096 to 1099, and we're going to talk at length about it. The Turks replaced the Arabs, as we've already said, as the dominant group among the Muslims, and they were applying pressure westward. Constantinople was holding them off. We've already said that the pressure is mounting. In fact, they even had gone over into Eastern Europe some. The emperor at Constantinople called on the West for help. He called upon the Pope. Why call upon the Pope? Why not call upon the king? The Pope had more influence than the king did, and he knew that. And so we recall how that the Pope had made the king stand out in the weather and barefooted for 3 days at Canossa and plead forgiveness. There's no question who's more powerful. So you want to get the job done, go to the man who has the authority, the real authority, so he called upon the Pope. Well, he might as well have been talking to the wall if he had talked to the king anyway. He wasn't interested, not really, let's say for his own reasons. But finally, Pope Urban, who listened to this call, and he decided it was time to do something about it. After a while, they turned a deaf ear for a long time, and finally said, we've got to answer this call. And so Pope Urban made what Will Durant, the famous historian, Will and Arian Durant, they're both dead now, Arian Durant died not too long ago, called the most influential speech in medieval history. And it set the thing in motion. Boy, did it ever. You talk about a sermon that had an effect. As a result of this sermon, thousands of people died. All kinds of things happened. And it was sort of the same sermon he delivered in various places. At a gathering in Clermont in France, here's what he said. He's over there in France. Oh, and notice the appeal. This will give you an eye. If you want to stir a mob to action, this appeal, this excerpt from this sermon, a call for a crusade, will teach you how to do it. He'll leave anything out. Let's see. Oh, race of Franks, race beloved and chosen by God. From the confines of Jerusalem and from Constantinople, a grievous report has gone forth that an accursed race, wholly alienated from God, has finally invaded the lands of these Christians and is depopulated by pillage and by fire. Well, he calls for their racial pride. You, the Franks, are the most powerful of the Western tribe, Western peoples. You who are specially chosen by God, this race of infidels. What have they done? Well, they've depopulated by pillage and fire. They're burning they're burning Christians, which is really not true, by the way. It wasn't that bad, most places at least. Some of the captives they have carried away into their own country, and some they have killed by cruel torture. They destroy the altars, as of the churches, after having defiled them with their uncleanness, which was an overstatement. On whom then rests the labor of avenging these wrongs? If not upon you, you upon whom above all others God has conferred the remarkable glory in arms, you're the best fighters in the world, you see. Not you, who, you see? God has conferred a great bravery and strength to humble the heads of those who resist you. Let the deeds of your ancestors encourage you. Now, he's even calling on the dead. You know, remember your glorious history. Let them encourage you. The glory and grandeur of Charlemagne and your other monarchs. Let the holy sepulcher of our Lord and Savior, now in the hands of unclean nations, arouse you. And the holy places in the that are now, repeated there, and the holy places that are now stained with pollutions. Let none of your possessions keep you back, nor anxiety for your family affairs. This land which you now inhabit, shut in on all sides by sea and the mountains, speaks is too narrow for your large population. How'd that get into it? First he talks about, you know, the glory of your race, and then the terrible suffering imposed by the infidels upon Christians. They've taken over the Holy Land. Remember your honor. Remember your heritage. Remember how nice it is to have more real estate. isn't that what he's saying? He said, as he just changed gears, nobody noticed. Wouldn't it be great to have some free land? We're such a great people, we're hemmed in. Why should we, you know, have this population problem when all the infidels have so much territory? I think that's beautiful. I don't think anybody probably noticed that he'd stopped being a preacher and started being a real estate agent. It scarcely furnishes food enough for its cultivators. Hence it is that you murder and devour one another. We've talked about this. This landless people, you know, fighting for what land there was. You wage wars, and that many among you perish in civil strife. Let hatred, therefore, depart from among you. Let your quarrels end. Well, they were fighting each other regularly. Enter upon the road to the Holy Sepulchre. Wrest that land from a wicked race and subject it to yourself. So you can do, in other words, you can do God a favor, do yourself a favor. Save the church and get a kingdom, an estate. Jerusalem is a land fruitful above all others, a paradise of delights. It's a goodbye. That royal city, situated at the center of the earth, implores you to come to her aid. You see how he mixed the two together? It's a beautiful, man, it's a great land to grow anything. You can really have a nice there. It implores you to come to her aid. You know, rescue her for her, your own good and her good. Undertake this journey eagerly for the remission of your sins. Now, by that he meant what? Purgatory, see. Stay out of purgatory. It's additional merit. Be assured of the reward of imperishable glory in the kingdom of heaven. It was generally believed that if you died on a crusade, you couldn't be lost. But more important, the ancient medieval man was not concerned about being lost. That was the church would save him. He was concerned about having to pay for his debt in purgatory. That was the real concern. Well, what a sermon. He appealed to everything. Their racial pride, their religious sentiment, their greed, their desire to stay out of purgatory. What was the response of the people? The people cried, "Day is full. That is, God wills it." Urban took up the cry. God, you see this big crowd there in France, in Clermont. He's giving this stirring sermon, and we're going to go. We're going to liberate the land. And people, God wills it. And the Pope takes up the cry, becomes a cheerleader, and just worked them into a frenzy. And by the way, he said, make this your battle cry. And it did, by the way. When the crusaders would charge into battle, they would cry, "Day is full, God wills it." He urged them to wear a cross upon their breasts. And they did. They would embroidery a cross upon their armor, upon their banners. Many of the nobles and thousands of the common people, as I point out here, immediately pledged their lives and property to the cause. Monks and priests left their retreats to become soldiers for Christ. It was a famous phenomenon that historians talk about as the armor over the cowl. Remember the monk's cowl? If you'd be buried in a monk's cowl, you'd go to heaven. Thousands of these monks came out of their monasteries and put armor over their monk's cowl and became fighters. Well, for 9 months, Urban preached a crusade with equal response, being received. That is, he just did the same thing else all over Europe. And a lot of enthusiasm. It's one thing to get a lot of enthusiasm going, something else to get it organized. It's one thing to say, let's go, but who and when and where and who's going to be in charge and how you're going to feed them and where you're going to go, that's a different matter, you see. Urban assumed the right to release nobles as well as serfs from commitments that might hinder their going. If they had feudal commitments, he said, you can break them for Christ. He conferred on all crusaders the privilege of being tried in ecclesiastical courts for any crime which they might have been accused. And there were many. They loot and rape and pillage. The church would, you know, so the end justifies them. Don't worry about committing a crime. Don't worry about being accused of murder or rape, because the church will take care of you. He commanded a truce to all wars. Didn't work, but he commanded it. They fought right to the last minute anyway. Europe was genuinely united, I point out here, under the Pope as it feverishly prepared for a holy war. Urban promised complete indulgence for all who win, no time in purgatory. And now look at this last statement. This was the beginning of a new emphasis on indulgences, which was to have tremendous consequences. And we're going to see that it was the emphasis on indulgences that finally drove Martin Luther across the line. But this crusade was the beginning of a new emphasis on them. Not a creation of the idea, but really came into being, came into the fore. What about the campaign? Well, took a while to raise the armies, and there was a lot of hysteria, a lot of enthusiasm. And so what happened was, and you can read this, I'm just sort of summarizing a lot of events, but while the legitimate authorities, while the nobility and the church were getting things organized, a number of mobs simply got together and started off. They were led by such notables as Walter the Penniless and Peter the Hermit. Let's go. Well, we don't have any food. God will feed us. We don't have any weapons. Well, we don't need weapons. God will cause the enemy to fall before us. We don't have any boats to get there. God will let us walk on the water. That is, it's just a matter that the many actually believe, thousands believe this. These mobs, these holy men, Walter the Penniless, he's called, he couldn't take care of his credit cards. And Peter the Hermit, they just took off and said, God will just make the way. No problem. Well, it didn't work that way. The mobs, before they left, they attacked the Jews in Europe. Now, this is very important. You see, here's all this mob action, a very ignorant, superstitious, crude age. And these mobs are running around saying, let's go, let's go. Urban was a good, he should have organized it before he started preaching, but he didn't. And here they were, you can imagine all this pent-up fury. And then somebody got a very interesting idea. Nobody knows who got it exactly. You can trace it down to the first time it happened, but somebody said, well, now, why in the world should we, here we need land, we need money, why should we go all the way to the Holy Land, wherever that is, and fight the infidel? We've got infidels right here. And so that was only logical to them to kill the infidels in Europe before they went to get the infidels in Asia. And who were the infidels in Europe? The Jews. And so, as they began to travel, they had to live off the land, as I point out. Why not plunder the Christ killers? And they did plunder them. Why fight heretics so far away when there were heretics back home? And look at this statement. Learn this. This was the beginning of Jewish persecution in Europe. It began with the Crusades. When the fury raised by Urban against the Muslim infidels, as he called them, was redirected toward the Jews. They looted and raped in a general way, and as they began to travel, by the way, what happened was that many word got out about this mob or these mobs that were heading toward the Holy Land, and the Lord didn't feed them with manna from heaven, and so what they did was they would loot cities. And so cities began to close their gates. They were wall cities, began to close their gates against them, and the mobs either tore down the gates or they moved on, they began to starve. Some of the mobs finally did arrive at Constantinople, believe it or not. They got there. Hard to believe that they did, but they did. They were decimated, as most of them didn't. What was left of the mobs were decimated by famine and fighting. By the way, they fought each other daily, killed each other, stole from each other. It was just a horrible, horrible situation. There was plague, as you might expect. You can imagine the sanitary conditions weren't very good. There was leprosy. There was fever. The emperor welcomed them because he'd asked for help, and here they were, but he did not sufficiently feed them, so they began to plunder Constantinople, including the churches. The Christians came to kill the infidel and began looting the churches. And by the way, there was a lot of wealth in the churches in Constantinople, a very wealthy Byzantine city. Alexius, the emperor, finally shipped them across the straits, you see. Get him over and get him off his back, over, ship them right across here, over to the land of the Seljuk Turks. I got to get rid of these guys. He said, you want to fight the Turks? They're right across the water. Meet me in the morning and I'll get you a boat. And he did. He got the boats together and just shipped them across. Well, but he told them, he advised them to wait until the better equipped knights and the organized army showed up. But they didn't. The first town they came to was Nicaea. So they marched down here to Nicaea, where the famous Council of Nicaea was held. It's in Muslim hands. And they marched, and so they were going to attack Nicaea. Here were genuine Muslims. They finally found some Muslims to fight. So far, they'd only killed, they'd killed a lot of people. So far, they'd killed three classes of people. They'd killed Jews, and they'd killed Christians, and they killed each other. About it. And finally, had some Muslims to kill. And so, they the Muslims, they simply sent out, they saw what it was, the Muslims simply sent out a detachment of Turkish bowmen who simply marched out, pulled their arrows out of their quivers and slaughtered them. And that was the end of that. So much for the mobs. The armies finally got underway. They did, and by the way, they moved on down, and I make a long story short, they marched down. They also looted, and they had to fight their way. Some of the Christian cities would close their gates against them, so it was not easy, but you can read this. They finally made it down, and they actually did. The first full crusade did capture Jerusalem. It took them 3 years, and they started out with over 100,000. They were reduced to 12,000 combatants, that is, 12,000 who could fight. Christians massacred the Muslim inhabitants of Jerusalem. By the way, they also massacred several Christian villages. These are very ignorant people. What happened in several cities, and the Muslims just laughed about this. The Christians, who were having a hard time, Christians down in this area, were having a hard time of it, and they would hear that the Crusaders were coming, and so they would open their gates and go out to march out to meet them, to welcome them to their city. But they looked just like the Muslims. They wore the Oriental robes. And so when the knights saw them coming out, they simply fell on them and killed them. Didn't know who they were. In other words, you'd think they have sense enough to dress like a Christian. By that they meant a European Christian. Since you couldn't, they say there's no difference in race in the Muslims, no difference in dress, how are you going to tell? They didn't want to take any chances anyway. And so they killed a lot of Christians. Wiped out a lot of Christian communities. And they massacred the Muslim inhabitants of Jerusalem. Terrible slaughtering. And I mean, remind you what I said, that those who led this crusade were not the mob. Those who were out in front were the knights, the mounted knights. As I said, they were very good at warfare. They knew how to lay down a siege. They were professionals at the siege, which is the whole science of the ancient world. We could lecture for a long time on this. Very interesting, but they, just how to scientifically tear down a wall, reduce it. They were very good at it, and the Muslims simply could not stand against them. There were some interesting things that when the Muslims learned a lesson, the heart of the Turks, they'd had such a little trouble with the early mobs under Walter the Pantless and Peter the Hermit, and when the Crusaders showed up, they thought it was more of the same. They marched out rather casually, and lo and behold, before they knew what hit them, there was a tremendous slaughter. And they found out there was a difference between these mobs and these fellows they'd never seen before. These knights on their huge horses and their terrible armor. In fact, some of their weapons couldn't even penetrate that armor. Quite a story. By the way, if you want to read sort of a fictionalized, yet historically accurate picture of this, read that section that deals with the Crusades in Missioners, The Source. Book The Source. It's a good, a nice way to kind of look at that subject without reading, two or three volume sets of books. Yes. James Missioner, The Source. No, the medieval records. All over all kinds of medieval body of literature, sources, a lot of journals and just city records, all kinds of accounts. You can there are whole books just on the Crusades, whole studies. You can read that and check that for yourself, see what the sources are. What were the results of the First Crusade? Well, they founded four Latin kingdoms. You see, theoretically, they should have turned this land and been taken away from Constantinople, right? But obviously, these Europeans didn't have any intention whatever of turning the land over to the Emperor Constantinople. They took it, they're going to keep it. And I list these. There was the Kingdom of Jerusalem, the Principality of Antioch, the County or Duchy of Tripoli, and the County or Duchy of Edessa. They're on the map if you want to look at them. These were Latin kingdoms. And by the way, from this period, you have, and still have, a Roman Catholicism in Palestine. In the East. Remember, the East is the Orthodox Church, but there is a Roman Catholicism in the East and goes back to the times of the Crusades. Well, so out of this came four Latin kingdoms, There, out of this, a number of military orders were born out of this first crusade. The Hospitallers, the Templars, it was a monastic order of warriors. And by the way, this is the source of the Masonic Lodge. The Masonic Lodge grew out of this, the Templars, which were a monastic order of warriors, sort of a monastery on horseback. It's a kind of a class of chivalry. You see that? Or just sort of a lodge, or not a lot, they didn't call it a lodge, but an order. And they were just as you had, remember I talked about how you had, what the Cluniac Reform had orders of monasteries? Well, this was an order of knights. Knights Templar. And the Teutonic Knights was another order that came out of these organizations, clubs, you might call them. And you can read more about that if you choose. A new concept of warfare came out of this, and this is important. I'll list you the history of attitudes toward war, and some of this you'll recall. In the first 300 years of its history, the church was taught pacifism by the fathers. That is, those whose writings have survived. You remember that, don't you? After Constantine made the empire Christian, Augustine conceived of the just war. That is, one thing to be a pacifist as long as there's enough non-pacifists around to protect you. I've already said that. What about when you have a Christian nation, as Constantine wanted? And you got the barbarians pressing down from the north. Then you had Augustine develop the rule of a just war, that is, you could fight defensively and reluctantly. And he laid down four rules. You can study that later if you want to. But you got that? Before, no fighting. Now, you can fight, but only defensively and reluctantly. The crusade differed from the war fought reluctantly in the following ways. It was fought under the church rather than under the state. It was a holy war. Here you have the concept of the holy war. The common soldier volunteered for this, wasn't drafted. The common soldier had no personal responsibility for evaluating the ethics or morality involved. It was more or less what we practice today. That is, it was a war where he did not have to ask that question, was it right or wrong. And last, all qualms were erased. This was a holy cause in which to kill was to benefit Christ, to die was to gain salvation. This is the crusade, you see. To kill was to benefit Christ. Did they feel guilty when they went in and slaughtered people? They slaughtered a lot of Christians. When they found out about it, they said, well, so what? They're in heaven, and not our fault. They killed the Muslims by the thousands. By the way, the Muslims did not slaughter the way the Christians did. Christians just, you know, women and children, they took Jerusalem. It's terrible. But there are no qualms about it. Why? Well, these are infidels, and we're benefiting Christ and gaining salvation. So the first crusade was a success. By the first crusade, I don't mean the mobs that came. Now, the second crusade, what caused it? Well, one of the Latin kingdoms, Edessa, was lost. The Muslims began to regain some lost territory, and a threat existed for the other kingdoms. That is, they saw that if they didn't do something, they were going to lose what they had gained in the first crusade. Bernard of Clairvaux preached this one, and we're going to deal with Bernard later, so I'll just put that here. Does Urban preach the first one? Bernard of Clairvaux preached this one, very influential man. The armies this time came from France and Germany, and partly because they received little help and protection from Constantinople, these armies were cut to pieces in Asia Minor. That is what Constantinople wanted help, and so when the First Crusade came through, not the mob, First Crusade came through, they gave them help. Why didn't Constantinople help the second wave? Specifically what? Not the mobs now. Yeah, they didn't give the land back to them. They thought they were coming to liberate the land and give it back to who it belonged to in the first place. They didn't do that. They kept it for themselves. And so when the second crusade came through, Constantinople said, well, a lot of good is doing us. And so they would not really cooperate with them. The armies got into Asia Minor. The Muslims had learned to be more careful by now, and these armies were cut to pieces. Second crusade was a failure. It never got to Jerusalem. Third crusade, the cause was to capture, what happened was that Jerusalem was recaptured by the Muslims. And well, this really caused a stir. The armies came from France, Germany, and England this time. They were led by Frederick Barbarossa, the Redbeard, of Germany, Philip Augustus of France, and Richard the Lionhearted of England. And by the way, here's your famous King Richard. And this, by the way, Richard the Lionhearted was, he earned that name. He recognized as one of the greatest warriors that they have known. According to the records, he literally killed hundreds in battle. Well, that's exaggerated, I don't know. But even considering the exaggeration, he was the one man that nobody wanted to face in battle. He was quite something. By the way, Richard the Lionhearted is to ancient Muslim society what the boogeyman is to America. Very serious about that. Just the very name still is a sort of a mythological monster to Muslims in some parts of the Muslim world. You know that? He was something. Well, what happened? So here you had this Frederick Barbarossa of the Holy Roman Empire, Philip of France.